This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on African News Tonight.
You want to criminalize payment of ransom when you cannot protect me. So what are you criminalizing? You know, you want to arrest me for paying for my freedom when I'm not even free. Nobody's even free in this country, for instance. I sleep every day with my two eyes open, you know, because we hear gunshot.
That was El Amrion Ohen, a contract specialist who has worked in kidnap-prone areas of Nigeria on proposed legislation to criminalize payment of ransom. Details coming up also. The International Criminal Court is asking Sudan to hand over Ahmed Haroun, accused of war crimes in Darfur. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. A recent study by the Africa Center for Strategic Studies showed that Russia has bolstered its influence in Africa in recent years by playing the cards it has well, like employing a combination of mercenary and disinformation interventions in support of isolated African leaders or proxies. According to the study, Russia has had the most influence in Libya, Central African Republic, Sudan, Madagascar, Mozambique, and Mali. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shanawi spoke with Joseph Siegel, the author of the study, about the weak points in Africa that encouraged Russia to expand its influence and pursue its strategic goals in the continent.
Russia's use of mercenaries is a distinctive feature of its foreign policy in Africa. And this, along with its, you know, different disinformation campaigns, its armed for resources deals, violations of armed embargoes, election meddling, all of which Russia denies, of course, are particularly destabilizing for Africa. And, you know, Russia is able to do this because Africa provides an easy and attractive theater where Russia can advance its interests. And, you know, it does this by working with isolated African leaders who benefit from Russia's interventions in weak states, places that are unable to verify or block Russia's often opaque activities, or that would enable the public to push back against the complicity of its leaders. And Russia's bearing few reputational or financial costs for the instability that it's fomenting on the continent. And, you know, the result in Africa is a reduced level of national sovereignty and a reduced level of agency for African citizens.
So what are the Russian strategic goals in the African continent?
The first is that Russia seems to be making a very strong play to gain influence in Northeast Africa, particularly Libya, where it would like to be able to control and gain access to a number of the ports and oil reserves, both on and offshore. This would give it influence in the Eastern Mediterranean, which holds both the natural resource potential, but also is a main chokehold through the Suez Canal. This, of course, is on the southern front of Europe. And so it's a very strategic location. And Russia has also been engaging significantly in Egypt and Algeria. I think the second point I would emphasize is the interest in naval bases in the Red Sea. We have seen Russia make a concerted effort to set up agreements with Sudan and Port Sudan. They've been talking to Somaliland regarding access to the port of Berbera, talking to Eritreans about Massawa and Eritrea. And so, again, doing so would give Russia access to an important trade routes and naval passageways, including through the Bab al-Mandab off of Djibouti and Yemen. I think a third area of strategic interest for Russia is that it is trying to gain outsized influence in a number of targeted African countries, and it's doing this through relationships establishing with some 8 to 12 isolated, mostly autocratic leaders on the continent, especially those who have access to natural resources or strategic importance geographically. And by forming these personalized relationships, Russia is able to affect much greater influence in these countries than it would with a more conventional foreign policy strategy. The final objective is that Russia is trying to reshape the governance norms on continent and as part of a broader effort internationally to undermine the perception of the viability of democracy, and in so doing to negate the effectiveness of a rules-based international system.
So what are the basic non-military tools Russia used to achieve its strategic goals in Africa?
In addition to these unconventional measures, Russia does have some traditional sorts of foreign policy initiatives on the continent. These involve trade, most of which, though, are for arms for resources types of deals. Russia is the supplier of half of all the arms that come into Africa. But Russia has an educational program in Africa. It supports somewhere around 15,000 African university students studying in Russia every year. Russia has been investing heavily in nuclear power technology, and most advanced of these initiatives is in Egypt. There are plans to build a $60 billion nuclear power plant in Egypt, and Russia has already provided a $25 billion loan to the Egyptians to start the construction on this. But beyond Egypt, Russia is negotiating with 17 other African countries and has preliminary deals in the works with several others, including Ethiopia, Rwanda, Zambia, and Sudan. Finally, Russia is working through the UN Security Council Africa members. So Africa has three rotating members of the UN Security Council called the A3, and Russia focuses heavily on those three as a way of trying to leverage its influence on global issues.
That was Joseph Siegel of the Africa Center for Strategic Studies speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. Fighting has ravaged Ethiopia's Tigray region for 6 months, and severe hunger is mounting. The UN says at least 2 of the region's 6 million people have been displaced, and all sides in the conflict have been accused of committing human rights abuses. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken even went as far as to say the actions taking place in the Tigray region were a form of ethnic cleansing, as fighting between the Tigray People's Liberation Front, Ethiopian and Eritrean forces continue. The UN says 91% of the people living in the area are in dire need of emergency food assistance. VOA's Middle East correspondent and Istanbul bureau chief Heather Murdoch recently arrived in Ethiopia and visited an internal displacement camp in the regional capital of Mekelle today. She shared what she saw with International Edition Steve Miller.
They estimate that there's about 200,000 people displaced in Mekelle, the capital of the region, alone, and most of the displaced are outside. But we went to visit a camp today of about a little more than 7,000 people, and it's one of 26 camps in the city. And the situation is pretty dire. It's not as dire as the stories they tell about where they came from, but there's very little humanitarian aid, even here in the capital where there is access. The people we spoke to today, almost all of them, including the children, had not eaten before 2 p.m. No food had arrived. There's a shelter, but it's very, very crowded. It was a schoolhouse. And in one room, about, say, 10 meters by 6 meters, 82 people were sleeping. And that was sort of the average of how many people were in the space. And this is one of the newer camps. A lot of the camps aren't accepting anybody because they're just completely packed. And they're hoping they'll build more because people are still coming. And this camp wants to stop accepting people because they're so crowded and there's so little resources. But there's nothing to be done about the fact that people are still fleeing the region for the capital.
Heather, have you been able to speak to any government officials or any NGO administrators about the need for humanitarian assistance, not only in the capital, but throughout the region, since so many people are in dire need?
Yes. We have spoke to some people about this, and especially we spoke to the head of the camp that we were visiting today, although he was a displaced person himself. He was not an official outside organization. It is well understood that people outside of the region-controlled directly by the Ethiopian government is pretty much cut off from humanitarian aid, from access to journalists as well. And there's great fears that a famine is already beginning or is coming, and there's certainly food insecurity even in the safest parts of this region. So in the least safe parts of the region, it's assumed that the situation is not only terrible now, but getting worse very rapidly.
Heather, I want to go back to something you mentioned just a moment ago. You mentioned that in speaking with some of the individuals in the camps, they said that while the situation in the internally displaced camps is bad, where they came from, where they fled from, was worse. Were they able to recount any of the stories that you could share with our international listeners?
Yeah, I spoke to several people today who shared with me why and how they fled their homes. And, for example, I spoke to one woman who had a baby in her arms who was injured visibly. His arm cannot bend, and it is burnt and cracked with blood. A couple of months ago, she fled her home when the war suddenly broke out. She was at the marketplace shopping on a Saturday, and suddenly soldiers rolled into town and gunfire began. She went home. She told her sister, who was making coffee at the time, that we had to run, and she and her children and her sister just fled their houses on foot. And then spent several weeks running or hiding in from village to village, hiding from soldiers. They were talking about Eritrean soldiers. They were specifically in that area. But as you said, there are other military groups involved in the fight, and so it just depends where they're coming from. So they were running from Eritrean soldiers or fights between the Eritrean soldiers and the local, the TPLF, the Tigray fighters that are still in the area, but outside of the main city. And then she made her way finally to Mekelle, even though she had to escape because they told her she couldn't leave. And in Mekelle, she finally got to a doctor after about a couple of months on the run. And the doctor said she was too late and said, the doctor said, where have you been? You know, you're too late. This child could have had an operation to fix his arm, but now he's crippled. And she was heartbroken and also terrified that she's never going to be able to go home and scared to stay where she is. But like, as I said before, she was one of the many people to today who by mid-afternoon hadn't had a single bite to eat and had no way of getting food unless somebody shows up to bring it for her.
That was Heather Murdoch, VOA's Middle East correspondent and Istanbul bureau chief, speaking with International Edition host Steve Miller from Mekelle, Tigray. The Pan-African Parliament, hosted by South Africa, has come under heavy criticism after fights broke out over how to choose the group's president. The majority West wants direct elections to continue, while the South wants a rotational process adopted. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
A male parliamentarian kicked a female colleague from South Africa. A female parliamentarian from Zimbabwe left nursing a sore hand after a scuffle with three male colleagues. These were amongst the chaotic scenes for 3 days in a row at the Pan-African Parliament in Midrand, South Africa. From its establishment in 2004, the Pan-African Parliament has been led by Francophone countries taking advantage of their numbers on votes. But English-speaking countries, largely in the south and some in the north, said they could not take it anymore and demanded rotational chances for the presidency. Zimbabwean parliamentarian Barbara Rodzi led them.
I do not agree with going ahead with these elections unless we observe and we follow what has been written to the clerk of this parliament. I submit.
But those from the Francophone countries were having none of it, leading to outbursts, insult, and physical manhandling. Roger Nkodo Dang from Cameroon is the outgoing president.
If you want to apply rotation, we'll start long term ago. I has been elected twice. Southern region bring the candidate. Northern region bring the candidate. I beat him the election.
But South African parliamentarian Pemima Jodina strongly objected.
You people from the Francophones, you're trying to do that. You're not honest.
After 3 days, the election was called off and the sitting suspended in an effort to cool tempers. South Africa's ruling African National Congress was the first to condemn the chaos and animosity. Phule Mabe is the spokesperson of the ANC.
The scenes we saw there are not commensurate with the kind of a pact that we ought to achieve of uniting the rest of Africa's people.
Mabuto Mabena, Secretary General of the Zimbabwe Communist Party, says the animosity is evidence of long-held hatred between some Africans.
As the Zimbabwe Communist Party, we reject this division based along the lines of the former colonizers, the French and the English. We must build unity within the African continent.
David Munyaye is an African studies expert at the University of Johannesburg.
We see it reflecting the weaknesses of the entire AU structure, and they somehow reflecting their parties and governments. And it speaks of the nature and character of governments that are there on the African continent.
Set up in 2004, the Pan-African Parliament is an organ of the African Union. It only has advisory and consultative powers. There are now calls for the African Union to intervene and save the continent from further embarrassment. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Twitter yesterday deleted a post by Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari that invoked the country's civil war. Buhari served in the army during Nigeria's 1967 to 1970 civil war. In a series of tweets, Buhari, using language Twitter flagged as abusive, said regional secessionists did not remember the tragedy of the conflict. Buhari's comments followed increased attacks in recent weeks, particularly on government buildings and police stations in southeastern Nigeria that authorities have blamed on the separatist group, the Indigenous People of Biafra, or IPOB. The banned group, which has pushed for a separatist Igbo state, has denied involvement. In his now deleted tweets, Buhari said many of those misbehaving today are too young to be aware of the destruction and loss of lives that occurred during the civil war and the challenges of being in the field for 30 months. He said he would treat them in the language they understand. A bill to criminalize payment of ransom in Nigeria has passed its second reading in Parliament while sparking criticism as the country battled insecurity. Munachi Chooks in Abuja, Nigeria, has more.
Kidnapping for ransom has become Nigeria's latest security problem. Thousands of Nigerians have been abducted and released for money over the years. In a recent report, Nigerian geopolitical intelligence firm SBN estimates that over $18 million were paid as ransom between 2011 and 2020. The bill's sponsor, Senator Ezenwa Francis Onyewuchi, complains that the kidnappings have become lucrative and that payments do not guarantee the release of victims. He notes that the governments of the UK and US discourage the payment of ransoms. But Abba Ejembe, an Abuja-based constitutional lawyer, has come out against the proposed bill.
It is ill-advised and shocking that a senator of the Federal Republic of Nigeria will contemplate such a bill, and that the Senate as a body will allow such a bill to even pass the second reading. He should have been killed at that point by other reasonable senator.
Ejembe says the proposed ransom bill appears to blame the families of victims for what is a very human reaction to ensure the survival of their abducted relatives. He's urging the Senate to look into all the bills that would fight kidnapping.
Rather than addressing the fundamental issues, the very issues that led to the collapse of the security infrastructure in Nigeria, allowing abductors, kidnappers to have a field day, the distinguished senator and the Senate indeed is considering a bill to criminalize those who pay ransom for the release of their loved ones.
Nigeria has one of the world's highest rates of kidnapping for ransom cases. The growing numbers have prompted the nation's parliament to begin debate on punishing citizens caught paying the criminals to release their loved ones. The bill was referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Human Rights and Legal Matters to report back within 4 weeks, after which it could be passed and forwarded to President Muhammadu Buhari to sign into law. L. Amarion Ohen, a contract specialist who has worked in kidnap-prone areas in northern Nigeria, laments the situation Nigerians have found themselves in.
You want to criminalize payment of ransom when you cannot protect me. When you cannot protect me. So what are you criminalizing? You know, you want to arrest me for paying for my freedom when I'm not even free. Nobody's even free in this country, for instance. I sleep every day with my two eyes open, you know, because we hear gunshots.
Some say poverty and proliferation of guns are driving the kidnappings. But security analyst Senator Irebu blames poor governance and the failure of the military and police to protect citizens.
There are a lot of ungoverned spaces. So and we are witnessing rapid weakening of state apparatus and strengthening of non-state actors, that are the criminal elements. And in a situation where criminals get emboldened, they keep on going ahead. No punishment is being meted out. So it becomes a phenomenon.
On April 20, gunmen invaded Greenfield University in northwestern Nigeria and kidnapped about 20 students, killing a member of staff in the process. 5 students were executed a few days later to force families and the government to pay ransom. It was later reported that the families had paid the equivalent of $440,000 for their release. For VOA News, Munachi Chooks from Abuja, Nigeria.
You're listening to African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Zimbabwe's vaccination rollout has been fairly smooth despite a few hiccups. Hesitancy remains an issue, and while the government has set up many vaccination centers for better reach, they often run out of stock, which experts warn derails the efforts. Reporter Kuzai Zanowashi has the details.
Itai Rusike, executive director for the Community Working Group on Health, has told local media that the shortages increase the likelihood of gaps in coverage, with many of those who managed to get one shot unable to get the recommended second dose. Trimo Sibanda is a Harare resident who was willing to take his first jab in Warren Park, one of Harare's vaccination centers.
And when we got there, we were turned away. They were saying that they've currently run out of stock. They didn't specify when. They just said we should just keep checking coming, since they were not quite sure when they might receive the stock. There were quite a lot of us. A lot of people were turned away that day.
Dr. Agnes Mahomba is the leader of the National COVID-19 Task Force. She says the shortages are non-existent.
We are hearing the shortages from you in social media. Minister of Health and Child Care, as we're speaking, has been working for the past 2 weeks redistributing vaccines to make sure that any facility that is moving faster than others would not run out. Those who are not vaccinating as many, the doses can be moved to the places where they are actually moving faster to make sure that, one, we don't get the vaccines expiring in one small site and yet others are not getting the vaccine.
As of Monday, 675,678 people had received their first dose since the rollout began in February, but only 344,400 had received their second dose. Critics worry the numbers speak to a bigger issue, where those who received their first dose are not following through with the second. But Dr. Norman Matara, with the Zimbabwe Association for Doctors for Human Rights, says the numbers do not hint at anything alarming.
I don't think people are defaulting. For example, if people take the first dose on the 1st, they are due for their second dose on the 28th. But between the 1st and the 28th, there will be a lot of people who will be taking also their first dose. So the cumulative for the first dose will always be higher.
The cumulative numbers recently went past 1 million. Not as high as the government had hoped, but experts say it's not bad either. though much more remains to be done. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zunamashe from Harare.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suwohibi in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Dan Brown, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.